LibertyNation.com does not endorse candidates, campaigns, or legislation, and this presentation is no endorsement.
LibertyNation.com. They're the resistance, but we are the uprising. With Scott Cosenza.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
We're in high school, I'd take you behind the gym and beat the hell out of him.
His Twitter account should be suspended.
Right. You want to go to work? Go take the job as an essential worker. Do it tomorrow.
I just don't even know why there aren't uprisings all over the country, and maybe there will be when people realize.
I think possibly that's the most unattractive form in which prejudice can be met in this country, is the rage of the entitled.
I'm high as a kite in my garage, and I can see through these guys.
Welcome one and all to the Uprising Podcast, the podcast of LibertyNation.com. I'm your host, Scott Cosenza, and thank you for listening and or watching. It's been a big week here with the death of a presidential nomination. And LN's editor-at-large, Jim Feit, will be here to talk about the administration withdrawing David Chipman's nomination ahead of the ATF. Arizona has made news, becoming the first state to ever eliminate peremptory strikes in jury trials. And we'll go into that and a report about the abortion ban and the Backpage trials finally underway. Remember that? Finally, a word from Justice Breyer on retirement, all on this week's Uprising. Well, before we go ahead and do bring in Mr. Feit, I wanted to have just a quick word about September 11th and the 20th anniversary of the attacks and what their legacy is. And I think it's a legacy that is a very troubling legacy for liberty. That, I think, really brought on the surveillance state in earnest. We have so many reports. We're now 20 years past the terrorist attacks, and you can look and go on YouTube just this past week and find video after video of government officials, whether it's at the post office or a police station or some other government official, who will harass and even physically assault or arrest people for instance, taking photographs. We have this, like, there was this terrorist deputization of every like small town cop thinking they're going to prevent the next 9/11. And while it's good for them to be vigilant for actual threats, the idea that every human is a threat is off the charts. And I think that's what we had. You know, there are these massive government programs that are sending money and equipment that was made to conduct wars for local police departments. And all that, I think, is accrued to increasing the power of the police and the state and the government and decreasing the power of the people. That war on photography, that it's all demonstrated right there, I think. You know, we have these license plate readers and the Stingray tech that is migrated from military use to civilian use. And there wasn't a big debate about these things. Police just adopted and started using them. For some of those Stingray things, which capture, they mimic cell phone towers and trick a person's phone into communicating with them instead of the intended actual tower, and they can steal data from people's phones that way. The federal government actually secretly kind of lets them use it without giving them the source code so that it can be discovered in court and used by defense attorneys to understand, you know, where these things are coming from. It's a real problem. And I think that has led us to where we are now with, for instance, the discussion of vaccine passports by serious people, as if this is some kind of viable thing that the government would provide some kind of internal passport for us to carry. We already have a problem alongside that whole notion of the war on photography. These videos, and I do suggest you go ahead and take a look at them, they almost always start with the police officers also trying to run the person for wants and warrants. They ask for a government-issued ID to do that. And the amount of police officers who don't understand that, A, you're allowed to take pictures if you're allowed to be there in the first place in public, and B, that without a substantial reason to suggest that some crime has been committed, some suspicion, you just can't demand somebody produce a government-issued ID. And I think that's all the legacy of September 11th. And really, in terms of return on investment, it's hard to beat Osama bin Laden's attack on the United States for what he spent to plan for those people to go to the flight schools and whatever else they put in place to make it happen. Because we conducted this 20-year, multi-trillion dollar war and doubled down on our own restrictions. And meanwhile, you know, when we go to the airport, we're still going to get hassled and sexually assaulted, even though we present no statistically speaking, no evidence that we would be or actual evidence that we'd be a danger on a flight. This whole security theater thing is another child of September 11th. So all in all, I think it's been an awful legacy for America. The one good thing I would say is that I remember somewhat fondly that we all seemed like Americans back then. It's sort of a quaint remembrance of, I feel like, how we all seem like one country rather than lately, which is this other thing. So now I could be wrong, but I think that former governor Schwarzenegger's comment about the vaccine stuff really hits the note for me on the legacy of 9/11.
And not just to think about, well, my freedom is being kind of disturbed here. No, screw your freedom.
Well, it's not all bad news this week. There's a great story about the would-be gun grabber David Chipman's nominee being pulled, and here is Jim Fite to talk about that. Welcome back to The Uprising, LibertyNation.com's editor-at-large, James Fite. Jim, you are, I think, along with me, one of the two writers on site that, you know, when there's a gun story that comes up, it gets sort of like, you know, either we're assigned or voluntold to it or we jump to it. Those are, you know, yeah. We're both interested in guns and we're both very much interested in what happens with gun regulation in the United States. And you wrote for LibertyNation.com the story, Controversial Gun Grabber David Chipman to Lose ATF Nomination. And boy, I cannot conceal my joy over the whole notion. Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so, you know, the White House didn't announce. Some unnamed sources close to the event announced to, you know, some reporters in the media that the White House planned to withdraw the nomination of David Chipman for ATF director. And ultimately, I think what happened was there was just too much of a backlash. He was too visibly anti-gun for even some Democrats, actually, which may shock some of our listeners, but there are actual pro-gun Democrats.
You know, I came across a pretty interesting piece of, not testimony, this is an interview that Chipman gave before the Democrats came to power. And here's what he has to say about how that kind of plays into it with the party politics.
Things have changed since Newtown, the Sandy Hook shooting. There was a time where the confirmation process was complicated, actually, because of Democrats who were not unified in their approach to gun violence prevention. And so during the time that B. Todd Jones was confirmed, it was actually trying to seek Democratic support as well as Republicans. But since the last Congress has become unified on the issue of gun violence, at least on the House side, the same has to happen in the Senate. And so if you'd asked me 6 months ago, I would say, wow, it seems that it would be very tough to think that Democrats would take over the Senate. I'm not sure that's the case today. And if Democrats were to take over the Senate and candidate Biden was to become president, I'm absolutely certain that the naming of an ATF director would be a number one priority. Yeah. And that the confirmation process, since Democrats would probably largely be agreed upon in advance about the type of person that they'd like to see to be candidate, that confirmation process would go differently.
Yeah, I like that. it, maybe it's not so as different as he thought it was.
Well, that's the thing. He says, you know, it's going to be the Democrats are going to be no problem, but the problem is going to be coming from the Republican side of things. And we know that that's not that didn't happen. The Democrats from, well, Joe Manchin, the Montana senator,
John Tester. And by the way, you know, Manchin should have been a given. That dude actually ran. When he ran for office, he ran under the Democrats for Life of America. So, I mean, he ran as an anti-abortion and actually pro-gun Democrat.
Yeah. So if you want to win West Virginia, it's hard to come out and be an anti-gunner like, you know,
the like all of those Democrats who didn't win office in West Virginia.
Yeah, right, right. And also even just to agree with the kind of national Democrat line that Joe Biden is, you know, put out there. And he's, of course, gun grabber in chief and has been for a very long time. But I wanted to juxtapose that that kind of political analysis that we see, the sophisticated political analysis we see from Mr. Chipman, who didn't get where he, like, you know, he is a politician as much as anything. That's sort of how you get to be in that, you know, nominated for the ATF director position. It's not like he was just kept his nose down and did a great job doing like field work. You know, he is a politician. And then I just wanted to juxtapose that with what we heard from him during his confirmation hearing.
So you think Heller was rightly decided, just to be clear about this?
Senator, I'm a cop, not a lawyer. What I know is the law is the law, and the Supreme Court plays a role in recognizing what those rights are. You know, as an agent, I felt like we were going down a highway. Our mission was to prevent crime, and the Constitution were those guardrails to keep us in line. And at times, when the road was uncertain, we had signposts, and those were attorneys who we asked advice and counsel. And so if confirmed as ATF director, that's the balance that I would strike. But the bottom line is our job is to prevent crimes from apparently that is ongoing right now that other members have suggested.
All right, Jim, the thing that just drove me nuts when I saw that, or not even nuts, but just the hypocrisy involved is when he says, like, I'm just a cop. It's so funny because it's like, you know, he goes from this sophisticated political, the sophisticated analysis of the political appointment of who's going to be the ATF director and like what they can get through, who they can get through. Okay. And then when it comes to asking questions that obviously the Republicans have about whether he's going to, you know, what is his move going to be on assault weapons or other gun controls? It's like, hey,
I'm just going to do the job.
Workaday beat cop, basically. You do the thing. But the whole reason why Biden wanted him in there was to kind of move the ball, right? To not just be, I mean, anybody can make sure that the ATF agents have appropriate, you know, HR, you know, things, that their transfers are being managed, that the needs of the department, like the kind of caretaker sort of thing you'd expect any normal agency head, right, to do.
Any management experience at all. I mean, I can, those aspects, I qualify for the job.
Right.
You know, I have no law enforcement experience at all, but
plenty
you
of
talk about.
But you can break down an AR-15 into its component parts, right? So,
well, I guess that probably actually does qualify me more than most ATF agents.
Yeah. I wonder if they say Chipman's a gun owner, like it's some kind of get out of jail free card. Like, hey, he's a gun owner. Like, don't worry about, you know, don't worry about him. And for what people.
Oh, yeah. For all people the all the authoritarians know, are. I mean,
what the main, I think, reason why so many gun control opponents objected to Mr. Chipman for is because when he left the ATF in his 25-year ATF career, he went immediately into the arms of the most strident gun banning advocating organizations in the United States and worked for them. In fact, in Jim,
he has
in your piece. All right. I got to read it. I swear to God, okay. I started reading this list and I thought, gee, it seems like it's overkill. But you list
the organization. He has literally worked with every gun control advocacy I've ever heard
of. I'm going to read it right now because it is fantastically long. The idea that this person can, you know, sort of be an honest broker for those of us who support the right to keep and bear arms. All right, here we go. Mayors against illegal guns, moms demand action, every town for gun safety, the Brady Campaign to Prevent Violence, the Coalition to Stop Gun Violence, the Joyce Foundation, Center for American Progress, Americans for Responsible Solutions, and Giffords Courage to Fight Gun Violence. Now, these are all, as you say, don't let the names fool you. These are not, you know, organizations that do anything other than advocate for the elimination of the right to keep and bear arms in the United States. Is that fair, or at least our understanding of it?
No, I mean, that's the names are pure propaganda, right? I mean, it's like Planned Parenthood, the largest abortion provider in the country. That's not planning for parenthood. That's planning against parenthood.
Do you think that that's what, you know, I mean, the writing's on the wall. That's the reason why Chipman couldn't win, right? Because of these affiliations.
I think that's it. And you talk about the guy being a politician. The answer he gave to the question of whether or not he thought Heller was rightfully decided was, I credit where credit's due. I loved his answer. It just didn't answer the question.
He finally did. I didn't, you know, I try not to post like too long clips, lest people get bored. But he did finally answer a direct question of whether he thought it was correctly decided as yes, which I thought. You know,
that was surprising.
He shouldn't. And also he shouldn't do it. In other words, if you want to be a cop, right? If your kind of path to the nomination is based on this idea of like, hey, I don't make the laws, I just implement them. Well, then you shouldn't put yourself in the position of being the Supreme Court justice and saying, you know, it was correctly decided. Just leave it be. Just say I'm here to, you know, to enforce the law and policy.
But that is kind of the exact opposite of what he did in that interview where he was talking about what it would take to get a, you know, a director approved.
What do you think? You know, this has been like the major gun control fight so far with the Biden administration. And I expect there's going to be more to come. What kind of damage do you think a guy like David Chipman can do versus this, the sort of like, let's say you pull off some accountant from the bowels of the ATF that has no bone, you know, on the gun control front. They just want the, you know, a defined benefit pension and to go home at 5 o'clock and put them in charge of the agency. Like, what is the difference, you know, a year later, 5 years later in how the American public, you know, deals with guns and gun laws?
Well, without addressing any sort of, I mean, if we just assume everything is on the up and up and there's no corrupt action or anything like that.
Right.
Because that would be, I mean, you know, I'm not going to sit here and make allegations or anything. So just my concern.
Well, we know this has been done in the past by agency heads in order to further the gun control movement. So it's not.
Yeah, absolutely. But I'm not going to be like, oh, David Chipman would do this because I have no idea.
You can't say for sure.
But anyways, my main concern is the fact that under the National Firearms Act, the ATF gets to define what is a firearm to some degree. And that is what worries me. Like we see the proposed rule changes for the 80% receivers and stuff like that. Something that you get from an activist ATF.
You want to explain what an 80% receiver is for those folks that are unfortunately so unaccultured in the gun world that they don't have the knowledge.
So, you know, before we had federal gun laws, it wasn't really, you know, home gunsmithing wasn't really that uncommon. And they kind of worked that into the gun laws where basically like, okay, if you build your own gun, as long as it's not a machine gun, you're good to go. As long as you follow certain rules.
You can never sell it, by the way. That's one of the rules. But if you want to build your own gun at home, you can do it. You don't have to be a federally registered firearms manufacturer to do it. And the laws that require all the serialization and things like that on firearms that are built for sale don't apply to you, right?
Right. And that's actually a good thing you point out, because I would hate for somebody to listen to this and be like, oh, dude, I'm just going to start. I'm going to get a bunch of 80% receivers and open
with
a business.
With the exception of don't talk to the police, which is the only legal advice I'm comfortable giving without actually hearing the facts. That's the only thing that I'll ever say on here that you can take as legal advice.
Right.
Use your right to remain silent. If the police have told you, have read you your rights, then don't speak to them. That's line about that. We will use it against you.
Absolutely. And on the whole, I believe you can give, like if you built a firearm and then later on you like gave it to your cousin or something, that's okay. you can't sell it. And I believe you, I'm not sure if that's current rules or part of what they're trying to change, but
well, what's changed now. And I'm sure you were going to get around to saying is just that that home gunsmithing thing has come full circle with the advent of the thermomoldic plastic, the plastic yeah. printing and all these other things whereby, you know, most folks, if you or I lived, you know, 150 years ago, maybe we would have the knowledge and interest and tech to make our own firearms, but that's going away. Well, I don't know what you got going on out there in the hinterlands. You might have a smelter and the capability of doing it. I unfortunately do not, but I do have the capability of setting up a plastic printer, buying a file and pressing print on it, or ordering one from another company. And that's sort of,
And to get back to the 80% receivers, that's always the danger with this topic is that I'm just going to dive off into the weeds.
Yeah, the two of us are probably especially dangerous. So let's bring it back around.
Yeah. So so an 80% receiver is just it's not even technically 80% done. It's just it's a lower receiver that's done enough that most people with adequate DIY skills can finish it out, but it's not so finished as to be considered legally a firearm and therefore to have the serial numbers, require a background check, all that good stuff.
And so the question was, what kind of result do we get from an ATF led by Chipman versus our hypothetical accountant? And the answer is,
right.
Yeah, he goes after those and he tries to push that to make it so that it is illegal. Right.
Right. Well, and also in one of the proposed rule changes that they've already put out.
Wait a
second.
He's,
rule
he's
changes,
just a
not
cop.
An actual change in the rule.
He's just a cop. He's not, not about right? changing rules. So
is also even upper receivers have to be registered.
And those are both upper and lower. That those are major components of the AR-15, the most popular right. rifle in America, and one that Chipman wants to, you know, that he wants to have all those millions and millions and millions of rifles registered as machine guns or like
right, because he
guns.
Considers them military weapons, which for someone with 25 years of experience in firearms law enforcement is disappointing.
I don't even know if that he like really does consider them that. It's just that that's the mechanism by which to require all this massive registration. So for people who don't know, you can buy a machine gun in the United States of America if you have a clean record. Depending on where you live, you might not be able to do it in some of the bluer places and a bunch of moolah because they have stopped production for machine guns that can be bought by civilians in 1986. That's when the law changed. So anything that was produced before then, you can do it, but you just need to have the chief law enforcement officer of your jurisdiction sign off on it, whether it's a county sheriff or police chief, and you have to go through multiple FBI checks and wait. It's I talked to a firearms lawyer last week for a story about the Hawaii gun control law that got dialed back with their crazy waiting period. Mr. Stambouli, I think his name was, and he was telling me that it's over a year now for
yeah. I was thinking a year or two.
Yeah. So that's
a good point. Like you could actually, if everything is good to go, you can, as an American citizen,
buy
like a Vietnam era
M60
machine gun.
Yeah. I've shot
you can afford
one.
To feed that beast.
It's fantastic. And if they weren't fantastically expensive, I would own one. But because of that production limitation that the law allows. But the point is, he wanted to have everybody have to go through that level of registration for their AR-15. That's the rule. That seems to me to be like the straw that breaks the camel's back. If you're in West Virginia,
yeah.
How can you... You know, if you're Manchin or if you're and that Angus guy from Maine, how can
Angus
you say
King.
To the yeah Angus King, how can you say to the shooters in your state like, yeah, this guy doesn't want to take your guns away when he wants to make it so onerous to register and keep them? I mean, it's not just like one and done either. The way that works is if you want to take your firearm out of state, for instance, you have to call for permission to say, I want to go travel to another state with my firearm. Is that okay?
Yeah. 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 It's basically, I mean, I could see some Democrats pushing this to the base, to even some of their firearm owner base by saying, oh, he's not trying to take your guns. And then just leaving off the part of like, he just wants to make it so hard to have them that you can't afford it.
Yeah. Well,
and is about as many people that as own, you know, M4s, M16s, and M60s will eventually own AR-15s, which is very few.
Yeah, I have to tell you have to be mindful that there's, for so many people listening, those are just numbers and letters.
Fair enough, machine guns.
Yeah, a machine gun. Well, that's sort of what they did with, I mean, really, the worst gun control move in the past, in recent history, to my mind, is Trump's bump stock ban. And this is the kind of thing that we can see it under a Trump administration. Boy, what kind of ad hoc bans that, you know, under a Biden activist ATF director, it seems like the world would be their oyster in terms of what they can go for. I slacked you that old article from the housing and urban development thing. Did you take a look at that?
Yeah.
So I remember, you know, in Bill Clinton's administration is the last time we had an administration really dedicated to gun control. Obama didn't touch Clinton in terms of sending out and putting through the entirety of the executive and all their surrogates, like everything they could do. And I was reading about that. And this has to do with the current director of the CDC, Ms. Walensky, I believe, and her musings that she's going to use her office to advance. Now, she doesn't say gun control, but basically shootings as a disease model. And it reminded me of that.
Right. Yeah. She's not here for gun control. She's here to save lives.
Yeah. And how they did it in Clinton administration. This is just sort of the thing of how bad it can get if you have the wrong administrator in there. And it was Andrew Cuomo, who was Clinton's housing and urban development director for a while. And what they did was, in order to crush gun manufacturing in the United States, it was Cuomo's idea to create clients in the form of federal housing developments and the housing development districts and get them to hire lawyers to then sue gun manufacturers because violence surrounding housing projects
in urban areas,
elevated. And therefore, it was somehow the liability of the gun manufacturers that these housing projects had really high levels of violence. Now, you can think about the tenuous connections between all those things. And this wasn't a statute that Congress had advanced or said, go ahead and do this. You have this authorization. This is a law. This was just the clever thinking of Cuomo and Clinton on how to use the mechanisms of government to sort of frustrate Americans' rights, even though the right might be the same. But if you can't, you know, a lot of these gun manufacturers, you know, they're not like these overcapitalized companies. Like, they're on, you know, relative shoestring, and they can't have, they don't have millions of dollars for lengthy legal battles. So it was a way to kill it. And here we have Walensky on CNN doing the same thing.
In the 1990s, the NRA convinced Congress to cut all of CDC's funding for gun research, a loss equivalent to millions of dollars a year. Fearing further cuts, CDC leaders publicly were all but silent for decades, even as tens of thousands of Americans died from gun violence year after year after year. But now, in a stunning turn, the current director of the CDC is announcing a plan to reduce gun violence, sharing it exclusively with CNN.
She talks about, or the, you know, the clip discusses the, how, you know, all these directors have been scared to really speak out on gun violence for fear of losing more funding. And they kind of position the whole funding thing as like, oh, you know, the NRA wanted to pull any funding for studying the epidemic of gun violence, which is this public health issue. But, you know, what that was actually intended to do was stop things like that Cuomo Clinton thing, having money funneled into these things to undermine the right to bear arms from a lot of times just from an economic standpoint. You know, if nobody's making guns, you can't buy one.
Right, right. There was, it might have been Daniel Patrick Moynihan who had the bright idea popularized to tax ammunition at 20,000%. And they were going to control guns that way. They thought, well, it'll...
Yeah, but, you know, Chris Rock did a skit where he was talking about who needs gun control. We need bullet control. If bullets cost $5,000 a piece, you'd only shoot somebody if you really needed to.
Yeah. Sadly, the funny thing is, though, if bullets really were, if cartridges were fantastically expensive, it probably wouldn't diminish the use of firearms for Saturday night special level settling of disputes, because people would lay out the couple hundred bucks to shoot somebody for that.
Right.
But it's the people like you and me that want to go in the backyard or down.
Yeah, we can't afford to train.
And plinking some cans. Yeah, we're you know.
Never mind shooting for fun. We can't afford to train. So if we have to use a gun in a defensive situation, we're more dangerous to the general public. Because we don't know what we're doing.
All right. Do you have a wish list of, like, and I don't mean, you know, we're not going to get, you know, Colonel Cooper is head of the ATF. So, you know, is there a wish, like, who in the Biden administration could we hope for to actually be the ATF director? You know, it's like this whole thing in the argument where it's like you say, all right, you pick a solution for the other person that they would agree with. Like, who would you pick that you think Biden could actually get behind and say, all right, this is, you know, a favorable pick that you know, won't diminish liberty too much?
Man, I don't know. Beto O'Rourke. No, I'm just kidding, of course. I mean, you know,
well, we can leave that. We can leave that there, because I'll tell you what, that to me, that says a lot. And what I mean by that is I actually don't think there is one. Biden is
like maybe some random accountant like we were discussing earlier. But
Biden is so entrenched in the anti-gun movement, I feel like, and so bought into, you know, when Beto said that, and I'll play it now just for people.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15, your AK-47. We're not going to allow it to be used against our fellow Americans anymore.
Biden ran to him and said that he did a great job and he wanted him with his campaign. That was, you know,
it's what made him his gun control czar.
Absolutely. And the idea that that person could then turn around and sort of convince those of us that are animated for gun rights that he's some kind of honest broker. Well, doesn't pass this lab test.
Sometimes, you know, you just got to say thank God for the internet, because it immortalizes anything you're dumb enough to post on the internet. It's there forever.
Yeah, we have that. Yeah. I think probably in large part to thank for Mr. Chipman's dismissal. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, and the same thing if, like, I mean, you know, Lord forbid, Beto O'Rourke was the next candidate. I mean, I think that's kind of, I don't think that's likely, but you know, thank God we have the internet and all the clips of the hell yes, we're coming to take your AR-15 mm-hmm. through AK-47s.
Yeah, I don't want to give any ideas with that Beto comment, but I do think that he's even more radical than Chipman. So hopefully right. It won't move in that direction.
Well, Chipman is probably, to be honest, a smoother politician.
Yes.
Than Beto.
Yeah. Which is funny, because he didn't spend his life being a politician. He kind of came to it rather later. So, all right, well, we'll congratulate him on his return to the private sector. And he never left the Gifford Center for, you know, advocating to strip Americans away from their Second Amendment. So he'll go from the nominee to back to advocating against the active. Yeah.
Which he never actually stopped doing.
Right. Okay, well, we'll leave it there and continue to enjoy your reporting on this issue on the pages of LibertyNation.com. Editor-at-Large Jim Feit, thanks for joining us on this uprising.
Hey, thanks for having me, man.
Cheers. Arizona did something that no state has ever done in their legal universe, and it's been unreported, but I think it's going to be a big deal in the future when they kind of look back on it, all right? And it is the elimination of peremptory challenges in jury selection. This has been both civil and criminal juries. If you go to trial for any case, you're allowed to strike a juror or a would-be prospective juror for any legal cause. So the legal cause to strike a juror might include that they went to college and were roommates with one of the witnesses in the case. So they're not going to be able to evaluate that person's credibility on the same level that any other independent juror would, for instance. Or this will happen a lot of times when there's a family member, close family member, who's a police officer. If it's a criminal case and a police officer is testifying, people will sometimes say, I can't be skeptical of the testimony of a police officer because I believe they're only truthful. And the opposite is certainly true as well, which is some people say, I don't possess the ability to give a police officer the credit for being truthful because I'm so skeptical of that. That does happen from time to time. And both of those would be challenges for cause. If you can discover that information about your witness, you bring it to the judge's attention, you move to strike for cause, and that will be granted. Then there are these other strikes that aren't for any cause that can be articulated to the judge. So you can't prove that the person is biased or somehow otherwise not eligible for jury service because of them or their beliefs, but you know that there is something wrong with them. Maybe they just seem too eager to get on the jury. There was a guy in the Derek Chauvin trial for killing George Floyd who seemed like that. And in any case, those folks, you can strike them just by saying, I don't want them on the jury. You get a limited number, or previous to this Arizona change, in every other state currently, you have a limited number of peremptory challenges. You can just say, I don't like the cut of their jib. There's something wrong with that person. We don't want them on the jury. Now, the one exception to that has been race. There is a case called Batson v. Kentucky, where Mr. Batson was a defendant whose prosecutors eliminated all the black people from his jury. And it seemed like that they did so just for the purpose of making sure there were no black people on the jury. Batson was a black guy, charged with a crime, got convicted. And the Supreme Court said the one exception to the peremptory challenge rule was race. If the sole reason for striking a juror seems to be race-based, the Supreme Court said, then that is not a valid strike, and courts need to implement a kind of process by which you can challenge juror strike based on this Batson ruling. And how that works in practice, or has worked in practice mostly, is that defense attorneys get to challenge prosecutors when they strike a person of color from a jury. It's seldom used in the other direction, but it was actually in the Chauvin trial when the prosecutors challenged Eric Nelson's use of a peremptory challenge of a Hispanic person, and it was quite preposterous, the notion that he was trying to keep this Hispanic person off the jury because they were Hispanic. In any case, Judge Cahill ruled against that motion that the prosecution brought. But that type of strike would not be available here. It's no longer available in Arizona, and it's done in order to further the idea that there should be less discrimination in jury selection. There was a report revealed in, I think, May of this year that the Arizona Supreme Court, who made this rule — this is not like a legislature passed a rule, just like with the federal system, Arizona Supreme Court, you know, they're their own independent part of the government, and they made the rules for their court and whether these peremptory challenges can be eliminated. And they saw that prosecutors, for instance, will exercise peremptory challenges in a way outsized fashion against blacks than they will against any other group. And the same thing is true with plaintiffs in civil cases. So it's defense and defense, both in civil and criminal cases. Those attorneys favor blacks, and those in the opposed to those positions disfavor blacks on juries, typically. And that's what the statistics have revealed, and why the presumably why the court made its change. It didn't make the change with like an essay discussing why it made the change, but that's basically the nuts and bolts of why. The problem, though, is while what may work in terms of a statistical analysis, applying a solution, you know, if the statistics say one thing, that's good. But where it lacks the pressure relief of what's going on at the individual trial level, I want you to think about being on trial for your life for something that you didn't do. Let's say that the hypothetical actual innocent defendant, and they are out there, and you've got somebody on the venire, is what we call the panel that the jurors are selected from. And during the juror examination process, you just know there's something not quite right about this person, but it doesn't meet those limited four-cause strikes that you're allowed to lose. Well, now you in Arizona, you just have to take that person and hope that the crazy doesn't come out why they're on your, you know, judging your life. I don't think that it's going to work out well for individual defendants. It might help the statistical analysis, and that's good, but we're supposed to be about individual justice in the United States. So I suspect that when the first criminal jury trial goes and votes for a conviction, and the attorney was denied a peremptory challenge on that, they will run to the federal courts and say that peremptory challenges are required by our Constitution. And just because peremptory challenges aren't actually stated in the Constitution, that doesn't mean that they're not going to find some sympathetic ears at the Supreme Court for that argument. So we'll wait and see how that bears out. In other court news, Merrick Garland announces the United States government is suing Texas to have this abortion law declared unconstitutional.
Today, after a careful assessment of the facts and the law, the Justice Department has filed a lawsuit against the state of Texas. Our position is set out in detail in our complaint. Its basis is as follows. SB 8 bans nearly all abortions in the state after 6 weeks of pregnancy, before many women even know they are pregnant, and months before a pregnancy is viable. It does so even in cases of rape, sexual abuse, or incest. And it further prohibits any effort to aid the doctors who provide pre-viability abortions or the women who seek them. The act is clearly unconstitutional under long-standing Supreme Court precedent.
We'll see if the Supreme Court engages more with that Texas case, or maybe they punt on it altogether and wait for their own currently scheduled abortion ruling that discusses pre-viability restrictions that's currently scheduled for their docket this year. We'll have to see and obviously report on that. The one thing I would say, though, is that the Supreme Court didn't rule on the Texas law. That's been misreported in lots of places. It's not like that case worked its way up through the courts and there was a trial or a hearing and then opinions were made and arguments had. No, that wasn't the case. What was happened was there was an application for an injunction to stop the implementation of the law, and the court said they weren't going to grant that emergency relief application. So the case is still out there, and obviously we will cover it. The other big legal news this week is that the Backpage trial is finally underway. Backpage was a top 1,000 website with millions of daily visitors when it was seized by the government in 2018, and its owners or pseudo owners were prosecuted federally, alleging that they were a party to prostitution ads that were placed on the site. Now, it was a like a Craigslist kind of classified site that had lots of sex, commercial sex advertisements, but also other advertisements for rando classified stuff. Elizabeth Nolan Brown, for Reason, says the Backpage defense lawyers call for a mistrial after inflammatory opening statements. And I've always been cautious of this. We often see prosecutors talk about sex trafficking generally, and also and especially child sex trafficking, in order to justify outlays of investigatory resources and trial resources. But then when we peel back the layers of the onion, we find that they don't even bother making those sorts of charges. And that seems to what has gone on here. She says the federal trial of Backpage's founders and former executives launched last week, and it's off to a frustrating start. In the state's opening remarks, prosecutor Reggie Jones misrepresented Backpage ads and the law while harping on specific crimes of which the defendants aren't even accused. So what the prosecutor is doing, Reggie Jones, is they're bringing forth these horribly abused victims, victim survivors of sex trafficking. That they were trafficked is undeniable. But the people who owned the website that they were trafficked on did not know about it. And the mere mention and discussing and continuing bringing it up is basically trying to smear them with the taint of it. And it's sort of something we're used to seeing, but boy, it's a shame to continue to see it here. And this is one of these most widely kind of viewed trials with stellar defense attorneys, including First Amendment guru Mark Randazza and others. So we will keep our eyes on that. But if they can get away with it there, they could certainly get away with it anywhere. All right. Finally, we have Justice Breyer who was interviewed by NPR's Nina Totenberg and gave, I think, about the best possible answer about why he didn't want to continue talking about his retirement.
You did pretty well in the 2020 term. You wrote some very important opinions on the ACA, on student speech. You have advanced some important compromises on the court this past term. So at least as I look at things now, I would guess that at some time relatively early in the upcoming term, you will announce plans to retire. Am I wrong?
I'm only going to say that I'm not going to go beyond what I previously said on the subject, and that is that I do not believe I should stay on the Supreme Court or want to stay on the Supreme Court until I die. And when exactly I should retire or will retire has many complex parts to it. I think I'm aware of most of them, and I am and will consider them.
Well, what are the factors that adjust?
Oh, there are quite a few, and I'm not going beyond what I said for the simple reason that I would like this interview to be about my book.
That'll do it for this edition of The Uprising. Remember to hit Liberty Nation News for original articles, the Rabbit Hole podcast, and our signature television program, The Conservative Five. Just go to libertynation.com on your browser or hit Rumble, YouTube, or check out our Liberty Nation News Roku channel. I'm Scott Cosenza. Thanks for listening and watching. This is a program of libertynation.com, conservative news where truth matters.
Who are we? We are Americans that believe in liberty. We are a project of the nonprofit One Generation Away. We are patriots who apply the founding principles to the issues of today.
And they keep moving the goalposts on us.
We are educators and commentators who love America and the Constitution. Who are we? We are Liberty Nation.